Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is artist and cartoonist Jim Woodring. And we're talking about his monumental new publication, One Beautiful Spring Day. Jim, welcome to the show. It's such a pleasure to talk to you about this epic book.
Well, thank you, Mark. It's nice to talk to you, too.
This book blew my socks off. And we'll talk about it. I had such a great... I knew your work from before, but I decided to read the whole thing end-to-end in one sitting. And
wow.
It was like being shot out of a cannon into psychedelia or something.
It's a lot.
It's a lot. And the thing is, it just keeps changing and evolving, and so many things happen, and the characters come and go. And I got to ask you, how long did it take you? I know this is sort of a crass question to finish this work, because it's beautiful work too.
Well, the whole thing was done over a period of 10 years,
mm-hmm.
but I was working on other things too.
So had you sort of storyboarded this thing to the end, or did you just end arbitrarily?
No, the story of this book is really complex and hard for me to speak about, but I will if you want me to. Actually,
I do want you to, because
getting your reactions.
Well, you know,
the genesis of this.
The funny thing is, while I'm reading it, I'm thinking this book is evolving as he's drawing it.
Well, that's exactly right. See, I've been doing these Frank stories since the early 90s.
Yeah, yeah.
And the first story just popped entire into my head, and every subsequent story did up until about 2010 just pop into my head, and I would sit down and draw it up. I mean, I would sit down and write it out. It's a hard process to describe. I put myself into a receptive posture and start writing down sentences about Frank, and the ones that had this certain... gave me a certain frisson I would keep without thinking about them. And at the end, I had a storyline all described that I had drawn without or written down without really thinking about it. And then it was just a matter of laying it out, getting the page breaks right, and drawing it. And I did the whole thing in this very struggle-free, slow, dispassionate way.
I love that.
Yeah, me too, because the other work I do, I draw these kind of bizarre tableaus, and they're the usual struggle of working out a sketch and a composition and not liking it and doing it and thinking it could be better. But the Frank stories were easy to draw, and I always enjoyed looking at them when they were drawn.
And for people who haven't seen this book yet.
They went until about 2010 when I started a new story. I had the script in hand. I didn't like it, so I changed it.
Huh.
I decided that Frank should leave the place where he lived, encounter somebody, and bring that person back to be a companion with them. And then Frank and this other, and his companion would...
Whoa, stop there. Does the companion have a name?
Fran.
Okay. I wasn't sure of the sex of the companion, and that was fine.
It's all a little bit ambivalent. There are hints in there that they are sexually compatible.
It's very subtle hints.
Yeah, very subtle hints. But there's a scene where early on Frank, based on an I Ching reading, because this was a thing that I consciously put together, which was what caused me all this trouble.
Wow.
I had two dragons fighting in a meadow. Their blood was black and yellow, and Frank cut them in half. It was actually one dragon, and he cut it in half, and it became two dragons. And when he and Fran are walking away from her house, they see the two halves of the dragon copulating, and they're embarrassed. So it shows they have a sexual consciousness. But having him meet her and bring her back was not in the original plan. And after I did it, I realized that I had destroyed the franchise, because Frank had always gotten up at the crack of dawn and run out and explored his world with great avidity, and now he was like as good as married. So he sleeps in, he has a hobby, he sketches, he just doesn't have the old drive anymore.
Now, for people who have never seen your work before, let's talk about Frank.
Okay.
When I first saw Frank many years ago, he struck me as... this, I'm, can you hold on for a second?
Sure.
When I first saw Frank, he reminded me exactly of early cartoons from the 30s, specifically Fleischer Brothers cartoons and stuff like that. But he wasn't that. It wasn't a copy. It was even like the like bimbo, the original prehistoric image of this sort of anthropomorphic character. And I love that. Like, you can't quite put your fingers on it. It's ambiguous.
And you have expressed it perfectly.
And
for one thing, the Fleischer Brothers cartoons are deep in my DNA.
Oh my God, me too.
Especially one called Bimbo's Initiation.
Want to be a member?
I saw that when I was a little kid.
Want to be a member? Want to be a member?
Cornerstone of my entire life's philosophy.
That is a weird cartoon too. I can remember the first time I saw it. It's very odd.
Oh, it's great.
I know.
And it's subtle. You know, they're, when he's down in that mythic realm, they're playing Morpheus in the Underworld.
Yeah.
So it's all very, you know, they knew what they were doing there. But so, you know, I saw those things fleetingly, as one does when one is a child in the middle of the 20th century. You know, you don't get to see things on demand. So the Fleischer cartoons were these semi-mythological things that I had glimpsed as a kid. And when I was in my 30s and this urge popped into my head to create a generic cartoon anthropomorph who wasn't a dog or a cat or anything else, but just a pure cartoon, which is very much what you just described, Frank is what emerged.
Well, it's interesting because the original Betty Boop, actually, she had like dog ears.
She did.
And
she had that kind of cloven lower chin.
Yeah, thing, yeah.
Too. Yeah, there's a lot of things that you can sort of trace to sources in Frank,
what you've done is you seem to have purified it sort of distilled the essences of those kinds of experiences and then put into the character Frank. Now Frank comes in and there's a bunch of stuff that goes on. I don't want to give away anything for people who have yet to read this book, but then she's gone
and that was not planned. When I originally brought her into the picture, like I say, I went against the wishes of the story and brought her into the picture. And after I'd done that, I was contrite. and the voice that dictated the stories to me in the past said, okay, we'll fix this. Here's what we'll do. And the Fran story emerged where she was gotten rid of with a maximum of dignity.
Okay, yeah.
And then as a penance, I had to completely redraw the first six pages of the book Congress of the Animal line for line, except they have a different outcome. You come to a fork in the road and it takes a different fork. And that was because I had to show that I was really, really sorry that I had messed with this formula that had served me so well for so long.
Now, this book is 400 pages, and it ends exactly on 400.
Yes.
Is that significant? I mean, how did you end this? Like, talk to me about your mind, what's going on through your mind as you're going, okay, this is it. Because theoretically, I was getting into this like it could go on infinitely. And
well, it's interesting because the three books at the core of it, the 300-page collection of three books, they were not intended to be sequential exactly.
Okay.
On the title page of Fran, which is the book after Congress of the Animals, it says preceding and discontinuing Congress of the Animals. And on the title page of Poochie Town, which is the third book, it says discontinuing Fran and Congress of the Animals. So they weren't intended to be sequential.
You're covering your ass is what you're doing.
Of story, and I'm, you know, when I sat down to do the next one, the whole wraparound contextualizing material clump, which starts and ends the book and is worked into this story a little tiny bit, appeared to me, and it changed everything. It it changed those three books, put them in a different context. It undid my crime of changing the story and turned it into an artistic masterstroke, a catalytic brilliance. I mean, it was just amazing. I changed the past. I learned that I don't exist. There are so many things built into there that I hadn't even noticed. There's a sentence in that book, big and clear, that is so hidden nobody's ever found it. I didn't know I was putting it in there when I put it in.
Wait a minute. In One Beautiful Spring Day?
Yeah. There's a sentence in English worked into the fabric of that book. And it's the punchline to the whole thing, in a way.
Now I have to go back and reread it again.
Yeah, well, good luck finding it. I don't think anybody has. It's one
because we should say
the title. When my son was young, I used to read to him, and I would start all the stories. One Beautiful Spring Day, and then when I was working on this, that title popped into my head, and you know, all the titles of those books are ideas that just popped into my head and said, "This is the title." So I said, "Okay, this is the title: One Beautiful Spring Day." And then I had lettered it, and I was looking at it, and there were the words "One Day."
Oh, wow. Because we should also, for the benefit of the audience, say that this is basically a wordless epic.
Yeah, it is a wordless epic. But those words "one day" are significant in the context of the recontextualization of the whole thing.
You just want to say that word.
I can't say it. You know, I've never been adroit that way.
Yeah, I haven't either. So don't make me say it.
What word?
Not saying it. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is artist, cartoonist Jim Woodring. And we're talking about his epic, One Beautiful Spring Day. It's an amazing work. Jim, are there names for all the characters?
There are names for all the main characters.
Okay, for instance, I found myself starting to come up with my own names for characters like Pigman and that old Devil Moon. There was a sort of a punch character that had all the knives in the back.
Right, he does not have a name.
What's the old Devil Moon, the real skinny one?
His name is Whim.
W-H-I-M?
Whim, yes.
Wow. And how about Pigman?
Manhog.
Okay, I was close.
You were very close.
These characters, they have their own life and their own sense of who they are and what they do. Like, Pigman's a really Manhog. He's a really unusual character. He's sort of disgusting at times, but then he's sort of helpful at times, but then you can't really trust him.
Well, yeah, you're right. He's the most human of anybody.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah.
And he's the only character with the potential for change. And he has suffered terribly. Terribly.
You could read between the lines. You sense that he'd gone through a lot. And he sort of redeems himself for a while in this book.
Oh, he does. He does. He does. And the way Poochie Town ended, he was terribly wronged. You know, he had been terribly betrayed by Frank, and that's how that book ended. And then when the new material came along,
yeah,
and he sought his revenge, that kind of changed everything. There's a book called Weathercraft, which is also 100 pages long, and it opens with 30 pages of him going through the worst trials imaginable of a physical nature.
And that brought him to where he is today.
Well, like as in all the previous stories before he got involved in the mess that became One Beautiful Spring Day, the stories had this structure. They would start out, go somewhere, something would develop, that thing would be undone, and they would end with the equilibrium restored.
Huh.
So Weathercraft, even though Manhog goes through these dreadful agonies and then becomes, let's say, saintly, and then performs an act of supreme altruism, after all that, he ends up exactly as he was when the story started.
Wow.
Without any of the benefits of these experiences.
Do you track the lives of all the characters as closely as you track Frank and Fran?
No, in fact, I don't really track them at all because the stories come to me almost as if, like I say, as if they were being dictated to me. So it's like I'm looking at, when these things are done, it's like I'm looking at movies that other people have made, and I don't really know what's happening that's not on the page there.
That's fascinating because there have been other visionary creative people. Ramanujan was an Indian mathematician who used to see visions of a blood wall and calculus equations would be written on it in a finger. And this is a true story. It was from the early part of the 20th century. And he solved mathematical problems that way.
Really?
Yeah.
I've heard of him, but I never heard that.
Oh, yeah.
Ramanujan, that's amazing.
Yeah. And you sound like you're working the same way.
Well, you know, my entire life and my entire career have been devoted to exploring and understanding and escaping from my inner life.
Huh.
That has really been the main focus of my life, and I'm convinced that the Frank stories that I've done, and especially One Beautiful Spring Day, are some aspect of myself talking to me about myself and telling me things which I need to know in order to improve my life.
Wow.
That isn't how I didn't feel that way about these stories until I had this book in my hands and I was looking at it and I was thinking, this is to me, about me, for me. You know, I've often said if only one person likes my work, then I've done my job, but that one person turns out to be me.
Well, obviously a lot of other people enjoy the work too.
Well, that kind of amazes me because, well, it doesn't amaze me.
It shouldn't. Come on.
I mean, it amazes me now that I know how personal it is. I always thought, oh, these comics are good and interesting. I can see why people like them. I feel privileged to do them. But with One Beautiful Spring Day, it's like the owner's manual to my entire body of neuroses and experience and how I've dealt with things. I mean, it's just shockingly personal when I look at it this way.
I can see that. But then you know what happens? As a reader, you start to see parts of, not all of it, but you start to see parts of it reflecting back on you as a reader other than you.
Oh, yes. Well, I'm
because there's sort of a Rorschach aspect to the way things flow. I mean, the most amazing thing to me about this book is the flow. It flows and changes and metamorphosizes and does all these things at a consistent rate. So when you sit there and you read the book, it is an experience to read this book.
Good.
So I have to ask you, so 400 pages, were you determined it was not going to go one page more?
Well, no, but it just made sense. I had gotten used to the rhythm of working in things in 100-page increments, and I just...
Like even, now you mean that not sort of 100 pages, but exactly 100
pages. No, exactly. No, I worked it out. It was a little bit difficult because I had to determine how much was going to be, you know... a prelude and how much was going to be resolution.
Wow.
So it was a little tricky having to break it down into two parts and then fit the action into those areas.
Wow.
But it wasn't very difficult.
Jeez. The other thing is the black and white artwork is just shimmering. It's beautiful.
Thank you.
But it's also disturbing.
Well, yeah.
I had this weird dream, and this is absolutely true, that Jean-Paul Sartre, like, picked up this book and just got frightened and jumped out of a train.
Really?
Well, Sartre, stuff that oozes and changes and stuff, he wrote an entire book about that experience, nausea.
Yeah,
and he hated that.
That's...
And he took mescaline while he was on a train once and saw orangutans and stuff like that. And I thought it would have been an amazing thing to send this book to Sartre.
That book would probably just have been one 400-page grease spot on a brown paper bag.
You're right. Wow. I want to talk to you about your color work.
Okay.
Your color work is such a different visual experience than your black and white book. Did you always want to do just black and white?
Well, no. I always wanted to make pictures.
Okay.
I always wanted to make images. So I paint in oil and watercolor, but I'm not a painter. A real painter looks at my work and thinks, oh, this guy's a rank amateur, which I am, but I'm not trying to compete with painters. I'm trying to create images.
Right. It's a very different experience looking at one of these sort of collections of characters in color than it is in black and white.
It is.
It creates clearer boundaries, I think.
Well, yeah, there is a difference. It's hard for me to say what it is. Clearer boundaries. That's interesting.
Because everything's in black and white. Everything can blend into each other, essentially, because there's no differentiation.
Well, one thing about the black and white is those wavy lines.
Oh, those freaked me out.
The initial formula.
those
give the whole thing a kind of vibrating quality.
It does.
Essential to it.
It does.
And one of the disciplines of doing the strip is that there's no cross-hashing at all. All those lines never cross over each other. All the thicknesses, the densities, the changes in tone are caused by making the lines thicker or thinner. There's no cross-hatching at all.
Wow.
A senseless, meaningless stricture I imposed upon myself just for the fun of it.
Now, you didn't draw those by hand.
Oh, yeah. They're all drawn in pen and ink.
Jim, are you serious?
Yeah, it says so right on the dust jacket.
I'm in awe.
Really? No, it's all pen and ink on brick.
All those wavy lines that are so regular that looks like they're press tape or something.
Yeah, no, it's all hand done. Like I said, when I had to revisit the first story and have those first six pages, I had to redraw them line for line.
Well, you know, it's funny because I noticed there are a couple of times where there's two panels where, like, Frank is thinking or something like that.
Yeah.
And I noticed that there were minute differences between the two of them. I went, he actually didn't repeat the panel. He just redrew.
No, I never do that. No, it's everything there is hand-drawn.
Wow.
And there's a lot more drawing in a wordless story because if I want to show that time is...
Oh, yeah.
I'll show a grove of trees and then another shot of the same grove of trees, but the shadows have shifted. So, you know, it's about 3 hours later.
Well,
that's just tedious. In a regular comic, you can have a sign that says 3 hours later.
Yeah, it's also amazing how much background is taken up by word balloons.
Yeah, there's that too.
Frank, did you draw as a child extensively?
I tried to, but I had no talent. My ninth grade art school
How could you say
sent
you had...
me home with a note from my parents saying, drawing and painting is not Jim's forte.
Are you kidding me?
No, and he was right. I had no talent. My best friend in high school was a fantastic cartoonist, the greatest natural cartoonist I've ever known personally. And I just, you know, I just couldn't. He was like, I couldn't draw as well as him, and I just thought, well, this is it. I'm always going to be the guy who can't draw that well. And it wasn't until I was in my mid-20s that I was able to finally produce a picture that I liked.
What was the thing that brought that on?
I really don't know. I'd just been beating my head against that wall for so long, and then I just kind of cracked the code. I always wanted to draw because I always wanted to see certain things. The first time I drew a picture that I really liked, I was so mesmerized by it because it had everything I wanted to see in a picture, and my eye could bounce from one element to another like in a pinball game, and I could just see all these interrelationships and echoes, and because it was all stuff that meant a lot to me personally, it was like I had just created my own metaphysical porn or something. I mean, I was just enraptured by this. And I still, that's still the thing that I go for when I make a picture. I want to make something that will scratch some deep itch that I have to see something.
Talk to me about your style. Did it take a while to develop that style?
The Frank style?
Yeah.
Nope. No, it was changed a little tiny bit as I kind of standardized it, but it was all there from the first story on. Characters, the wavy lines.
Don't you think about that and how be amazed about how wild that is?
Oh, I think about it a lot, especially now that this book is out and I'm having to talk about it. And a lot of what I have to say is, yeah, it's really interesting the way it came together. There's so much there. There's this hidden thing. There's this rebus. There's this pun. There's this message. I didn't put any of it in there on purpose. Now, having said all that, that's about all I can say about it.
Wow.
That I didn't do, except for the part where I deviated from the script and did that Congress of the Animals book. it all comes to me as dictated, and I see my going AWOL like that as being now something great and interesting instead of just a major pain in the neck that I had to atone for.
I just have
so
to.
I don't know. The whole process is,
wow,
something that is beyond me.
Well, it's beyond your conscious mind. It's somewhere in you.
Pardon me?
It's beyond your conscious mind.
Yes. Beyond my conscious mind.
One last character I have to talk about, because this was a character that I found visually fascinating. There's a character that looks like an upholstered platypus.
An upholstered platypus? Oh, yeah. I call that character Quacky.
Okay. I just needed to know that. Now I can refer. Now when I reread this, I can actually refer to all these by name. How would you describe his personality? Sort of seems a little strange.
Franks?
No, Quacky.
Well, he's sort of a in a. He was originally a king, King Quacky.
He's got some royal accoutrements that he carries with him. Yeah, he's upscale.
Yeah, but he's not anymore. Now he's out in the world. When we meet him in this story, he's working in this horrible factory that Frank has to go get a job at. When we see him after that,
he's a maimed
bum on the street.
Oh, my God.
So he's come a long way, you know. Well, actually, the first time I think we see him is when he's in that balloon jettisoning things. And then after that, he's in the factory. But prior to being in the balloon, he was a king with a pink quartz throne.
Well, we're completely out of time. And I just want to say, in the Little Girl Lost episode of Twilight Zone, this is where she really should have appeared, was in this book. That's the world that she should have gone into.
Well, she might have been happier. You should check out that book, Weathercraft. There's some of that in there.
My guest tonight is artist and cartoonist Jim Woodring, and we're talking about his epic, beautiful, fascinating book, One Beautiful Spring Day. Jim, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you, Mark. You're my kind of guy.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.